Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Conversations Live, where we bring you the best in music, books, entertainment, and current events. When the movers and shakers of the world have something to say to you, they say it to us. Now, here is your host, Cyrus Webb.
And welcome back, everyone, to Conversations Live. I'm your host, Cyrus Webb. Glad you all could join us once again. Whether you're tuning in through Conversations Radio Network, we welcome you. Those joining us on the radio dial in Mississippi at WYAD 94.1 FM, we're glad you all could tune in with us today, as well as those joining us in Atlanta at 106 Live. We're glad to have all of you with us as well. Ian Scheffler has definitely been busy lately. It's been great watching him, not only on television, but also reading about his new book, Cracking the Cube. This is a fascinating look at something that a lot of us know about, that being the Rubik's Cube. But this book really showed me that I didn't know nearly as much as there was to know, and it was really fun to be able to read. The subtitle of the book is Going Slow to Go Fast and Other Unexpected Turns in the World of Competitive Rubik's Cube Solving. We'll talk to Ian not only about his journey as a journalist, but also as an individual who got involved in competing and what it was like for him to be able to share that with all of us. Now, if you're just hearing about the book, we'll tell you a little bit later how you can get it for yourself. But Ian, hello to you, and welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, Ian, I'm excited to be able to speak with you. I was sharing with you before we went on here. I was glad that we could talk because, as I said, you have a very busy schedule with this book. You've been all over the place. First of all, what has that been like for you to not only be able to share your own love of the Rubik's Cube, but also to be able to see the way that people are responding to the book?
Well, it's been a lot of fun, and one of the reasons that this became a project to which I devoted so much time in the first place is that I knew a lot of people had personal connections to the Rubik's Cube, and it's been really fun to sort of hear that at readings and see that in person, because this is something that has touched people all over the world.
Right. Exactly. And that's the interesting thing. I mean, there even is a part in the book, and that's why I was so excited to read it, Ian, because you actually share how it kind of went from just being something you were writing about to actually being what you called an obsession for yourself as well. I mean, what was that transition like for you to go from covering this and being able to find out and discover more about the founder and, of course, about the competition that were going on and then being involved in it yourself?
Well, it was sort of one of those things that happens all at once and yet very gradually because, you know, as I talk about in the book, I happened to go to summer camp years ago with one of the greatest Rubik's Cube solvers of all time, and he was the one who challenged me to get more personally involved when I did decide to write about it. But it was, you know, on the one hand, I thought, you know, it's I've never done a project like this before. I don't really know what I'm getting into. But on the other, it was this really amazing opportunity to understand something from the inside out and also from the outside in.
Right, exactly. Now, one of the things people may have seen if they have, you know, so any of the pre-release info that came out about the book, Ian, there was that great video that your publisher put out where you kind of talked a little bit about it. And one of the things that you talked about was the founder, you know, the creator of the Rubik's Cube, that being Erno Rubik. I had never heard the name before, I have to say. I'm one of these individuals who sometimes learned on a need-to-know basis. You know, I may hear about something and never think about, I wonder who made that, or I wonder where that came from. And it wasn't until reading this book that, you know, I was able to discover more about him. I mean, you, of course, were able to get a very nice endorsement for the book from him. What was that experience like for you to not only be able to read more about him, but also to be able to have the interaction yourself?
I would say it was pretty surreal from start to finish. I mean, the reason that a lot of folks, yourself included, and myself included, before I started this book, don't know much about the creator of Rubik's Cube is he doesn't necessarily want much to be known about him. He's, as I learned when trying to learn more about him, he's a lot like his own puzzle. There's different stories that don't always line up. It's a bit hard to know where he's coming from. But it was honestly one of the most enjoyable parts of all this because there's a history to this puzzle, you know, just the way there's a history to any of the things we take for granted, from the, you know, the combustion engine to the reason there's like four tines on most forks instead of three. And, you know, it was sort of this hidden history that was kind of right out there in the open, but no one had really looked for it before.
Right. I think that is the thing. And so for you, I mean, did that even make you even more interested in that the creator of the cube was such a mystery? Did that make you even more interested in the mystery of the cube itself?
Yes, and I think there's a real strong overlap. I mean, in my own mind, this book is about several journeys. It's about my journey to master solving the Rubik's Cube when I was coming from the point of most people, which is I don't know how to do this. You know, I know how to solve it, but I have no idea how to do it fast. And there was also this sort of parallel journey of trying to unlock Mr. Rubik and, you know, what's he about? And who is he? Where is he coming from? What was his story? You know, and it was equally challenging in a lot of ways. It took me 2 years to get just 1 hour of a sit-down interview with him.
Right. Exactly. And that, of course, takes us back to how we began this conversation, your journey as a journalist. I mean, talk to us about that, about the journalism aspect of this, Ian, because I love the fact of what you just shared, that we do get a lot of historical context, I think, into not only about Erno Rubik, as well as, of course, the, you know, the kind of history of competing with the Rubik's Cube. But also, as you said, you know, we're able to also see your own part in this journey and what it was able to meant for you. What is it that first got you into journalism? Was it just your natural curiosity about things, wanting to know more, or what is it that kind of made you say this was a field that you wanted to be involved in?
I think you hit the nail on the head there and with the word curiosity. I mean, I like to think of myself basically as someone who is professionally curious, which I think is what journalism really is. You want to learn about the world. You have questions to which you don't have the answers, whether you're trying to learn about what's going on in the Middle East or you're learning about a new science story or you're writing about what's going on in the State House. But, you know, you're not someone who just wants that information for yourself. You want to share it with other people. And that's certainly what I hope to do in this book, and it's also just what I want to do professionally, is sort of learn about things that about which I'm curious and then communicate it to other people. The writer Adam Gopnik, who you may know, I don't know if he'd call himself a journalist because at this point he's written many books and that sort of thing. He has described, you know, all good writing as beginning with obsession. There's something that you really that has gotten a hold of you, and it's now your job to explain to other people where that hold came from and make intelligible to them what you find interesting, because it might interest them as well.
Right. Exactly. I think that, again, is the fascinating part of it. For those who are just tuning in, either on the radio side or online, you're listening to Conversations Live. We're excited to welcome to our program today Ian Scheffler. He's on a whirlwind book tour right now, but he's taking some time to talk with us about his new book that's already an Amazon.com bestseller. It's called Cracking the Cube, Going Slow to Go Fast and Other Unexpected Turns in the World of Competitive Rubik's Cube Solving. You know, you also talk about the comeback, and this is interesting for me. I have to say, even before I got your book, Ian, this year, because I'm also an Amazon top reviewer, I get, you know, products all the time sent to me from different manufacturers. I've gotten at least 5 Rubik's Cubes this year. First year that's ever happened. From the small ones that you can take around as a keychain, from the very large ones that, you know, are more fun for my nephew, I think, to kind of play with than for myself. You talk about the comeback in the chapter, Cuber's Thumb. I want to read a bit of what you said there and what your hope was about the exhibit that you had a chance to see, and also, of course, about the historical context of the cube. You wrote this, for those who have the print edition of the book, on page 82. Indeed, Rubik's Cube has become something of an emblem for the modern age, crossing national borders, irrespective of language. It represents one of our greatest aspirations to make order out of chaos, and one of our growing fears that in a world becoming ever more complex, simple solutions are no longer so easy to come by. You go on to mention the new movie Snowden, but then you say this about the exhibit. I hope that the Beyond Rubik's Cube exhibit might offer some glimpse as to why, after so many years, Rubik's Cube was making a comeback. It wasn't just Rubik's Cube, you wrote. Cubing was growing too. But by 2012, the year I attended my first competition, about 20,000 people had participated in official tournaments worldwide. So talk to us about that and what you were able to learn about this comeback, and also, you know, that how throughout, you know, wherever you might go, how the Rubik's Cube was always kind of a part of society.
Yeah, so it was very funny to start getting involved in this project, and then, you know, it was almost like in the sixth sense where that young boy starts seeing dead people everywhere. I just saw Rubik's Cubes everywhere, and they were there already, but I had just never noticed them. It's so baked into our culture globally. Like, our culture is a species that we don't even think about it. I mean, and that's sort of a constant in the sense that, you know, I found a photo in an old National Geographic of two boys in loincloths in the jungles of Suriname playing with a Rubik's Cube, and they were just as into it as, you know, we are today. But, you know, you can see it in the news as a metaphor for the Middle East, as a metaphor for society. You can see it in movies. You can see it in TV shows. And as I say in the book, and as clearly your own experience shows, there's been this kind of tidal wave. It's just sort of the tides rising. And, you know, that figure that I cite in the book of by 2012, 20,000 people had participated. Here we are 4 years later. That number has risen to 60,000. So it's accelerating. And I think what's really amazing about this is it's not in one particular place. I mean, there are certain places that are hotbeds of cubing activity. Poland actually has more cubers per capita than any other nation on Earth. And in the community, we call it pro-land. I mean, they've had competitions in sports arenas now. But it's simultaneously happening in all countries, on all continents, with lots of different people, of lots of different ages. And as you read in that passage, that was one of the things I wanted to – that was sort of the third journey. There was the journey to find Rubik, the journey to solve the cube myself, and the journey to understand what is it about this really innocuous little child's toy that has had such staying power. Because, you know, I know there's a Troll Doll movie coming soon with that hit Justin Timberlake song, but Troll Dolls, it's not like you're getting sent Amazon review copies of Troll Dolls, unless I'm much mistaken. It's Rubik's Cubes.
Right.
You know, and so the funnily enough, I don't know if you want to hear my answer yet or if you want to build the suspense more, but the answer is to sort of what I found about this puzzle and its staying power was ironically that there is no one answer. The answer is that this cube, it contains a whole universe within itself. It's so complex and yet so simple. It's utterly intelligible. Anyone can pick it up, no matter whether you've never had contact with Western civilization or not, like those boys in the jungle, and you can grasp it. You don't have to know a certain language. You don't have to be a certain gender or race or nationality. You can immediately understand the challenge. And yet, because it is so complex, you can do so many things with it. You can make art out of it. You can make it the basis for science and technology problems. You can be inspired by it to make fashion. And so, you know, as Mr. Rubik himself said to me when I met him, it's at once a finished object, meaning it's self-contained, and yet it's unfinished, meaning the possibilities of doing something with it are just endless, and I think that's really what we've now rediscovered.
Right. I mentioned to you before we went on here, Ian, that one of the things that you referenced happened recently, just last year, and that was, of course, you know, your own experience publicly with the cube. I mean, you had been practicing. You had gotten up, you know, to a certain speed before the competition. It was a little bit slower during, but it definitely affected you. I mean, what was it like for you to not only to experience, but then to share with all of us about how you had gotten so involved and your feelings about it?
Well, this was a very deeply personal journey to solving the Rubik's Cube. I mean, I like to say, and it sounds cliched, but it's actually very true, that solving a Rubik's Cube is much less about solving the puzzle than solving yourself. It becomes a very philosophical exercise, almost a spiritual one, very much so if you're doing it in front of hundreds of people in a competitive atmosphere, because you really have to reach a high degree of inner calm to be able to solve it fast in that stressful situation. And so it became this very personal project to a degree I never could have imagined. I mean, as I say early on in the book, I had no anticipation of how deeply entwined my life would get with the cube, to the point that I was even cubing myself to sleep sometimes. I would just fall asleep the way some people have their Kindle and they're reading a book, and I was just twisting my cube, and I'd wake up and it was, you know, half solved, you know, 10 hours later or whatever. So it is something that, you know, is hard to imagine ever falling in love with, just solving this puzzle. But what makes it so unique is that, you know, it's never the same puzzle twice. Every single solve you ever do in your entire life will be different. And I played a lot of music growing up, actually. I played clarinet for like 10 years. It was a huge part of my life, and I found a lot of overlap with solving the cube, and that you have to diligently practice and that sort of thing. But you can have these really profound moments when you're performing on stage.
Yeah, I think that is it. Now, there was an interesting conversation that you had with an individual. I think the name was pronounced Baum, with Rubik, when you were there discussing. And I thought about it when you mentioned just a moment ago about the sport aspect. And one of the things that you wrote about in the book is that, you know, how different cubing is from other sports, and, you know, you went into that. What do you think has been one of the biggest misconceptions? Because as you said, something interesting as well, Ian, that it was less about solving, you know, the cube itself. It was really about you. I mean, so what do you think has been one of the biggest misconceptions maybe about the Rubik's Cube?
Well, you know, Cyrus, I think when a lot of people see a YouTube video of, say, you know, a young man, you know, in his teens who's solving a Rubik's Cube, a teenager, you know, there's this stereotype that, like, only sort of nerdy boys are the people doing this, or that you have to be young, male, and nerdy to succeed at the Rubik's Cube. But this is not at all true. I mean, as I show in the book, there are some extremely important female cubers in the history of it and in the present day who are very fast. You know, it's something that you can, you know, you don't have to be any particular kind of person or look a particular way or have a particular inclination in terms of liking math and engineering to be good at the puzzle. You know, like I say, it's, and this is true of any sporting activity. You can have a natural inclination for it, but a lot of it comes down to practice and this sort of diligent activity. But it does have this profound quality, as we're saying, that is so much more than just it being a mathematical sort of activity, which it is. But solving it fast at the end of the day is almost more like a jazz solo in my mind. It's like, you know, you learn your algorithm, have your sequences, you know, all the stuff that's kind of in your toolkit, which is really not too different from a musician knowing scales and, you know, chords and that sort of thing, and that's your toolkit, because each solve is just as improvisatory as a jazz solo. So you're taking those things, you know, and you're remixing them, and it's ultimately just as much right brain as left brain. It's very creative as well as being very mathematical.
Right. So once you had finished, you know, this journey, I'll put it this way, once you had gotten to the point that we read about in the book, what was your hope when people finished the book? I mean, what were you hoping they would take away, not only from the journey that you took, Ian, personally, but also that the journey that the Cube, quite frankly, has taken from the time that Erno created it?
Well, that's a really profound question, Cyrus, and I'll probably be thinking about it for quite a while. I mean, on the one hand, you know, I think if a book does its job well, it leaves the reader with something the author never could have intended. You know, I really hope that someday I'll speak to someone who's like, you know, this is what I got out of your book, and it wouldn't even be something I anticipated. You know, hopefully the book has enough layers that people will learn things I never could have imagined. But, you know, I think ideally what I would love people to take away from this is, you know, there's so much more to this than meets the naked eye, which really is true of a lot of things in life. But especially with something like the Rubik's Cube, that's this kind of pop culture icon, it's this totem, it means so much to so many people. I think it was personally very exciting to discover how much lay beneath the surface with the sort of secret history of it, with what is really involved in learning to solve it fast. And, you know, I would hope that someone can read that book and then start looking at things in their own life and being like, wow, like, I wonder what the history is of this. Like, what would happen to me if I get involved in this? You know, it was an experience that I certainly had and would love other people to share in, to, you know, really fall in love with something that you never knew you could fall in love with in the first place.
Yeah. I think that the other side of it for myself, when I finished the book, one of the things I thought about, and I'm curious as to your thoughts about this, Ian, is that, you know, I think for all of us there, when it comes to challenges, the importance of not running from them, but being able to embrace them and being able to think about what this challenge can teach us. Because it seems like when I finished Cracking the Cube, there was a lot that you learned about Ian, that the Cube actually, in this journey of the Cube, help you to take. Would you think that that's also one of the things that comes across in a book like this?
Yes, certainly. Well, you know, the very genesis of this was a challenge laid down by the young man who taught me to solve a Rubik's Cube years ago at summer camp, challenged me to go under 20 seconds, which isn't necessarily a challenge I would have known existed or even set for myself. But, you know, whenever you decide you're going to achieve a goal, which might seem impossible, you know, it really requires that you change yourself to get there. Because, you know, when I started out, I really didn't know what I was doing with the Rubik's Cube. And it was sort of, you know, in many ways, Rubik's Cube is a metaphor for life. This is something Jaden Smith has said. His father, Will, taught him to do the puzzle after he was taught by the kid who taught me, and for that movie, The Pursuit of Happiness. And, you know, the process of sort of problem solving, especially in regards to this puzzle, where, like, you learn very profound things about, you know, maybe you have a goal that's further off and you want to get to it, but you have to disrupt something you've already got going on and you're quite happy with, like, you know, a solved chunk of the puzzle or something in your own life to get to that further goal and then sort of put it all back together. It certainly taught me a lot of things about problem-solving skills, but it definitely did teach me sort of a new depth of, like, how far, you know, can I push myself? Because, you know, as I think the book makes clear, it was hardly a sort of easy road. You know, you want the hero's journey in any story to have some suffering. You want Odysseus to have a hard time making it back to Ithaca. But, you know, when it's your own life that you're talking about, you don't necessarily want there to be the biggest challenge. But really, it made me grow a lot to have to sort of put myself through these hoops, to learn things I never knew I could learn, to, you know, travel the world searching out these cube gurus. It was a really, you know, not only mind-expanding experience to learn to solve it fast, but it was an incredible journey to do what was required to get there.
Right. Well, it's a great journey that all of us are able to take thanks to the book, Ian, so we definitely appreciate that. Again, everyone, Ian Scheffler has been our guest. Great conversation with you. The book is entitled Cracking the Cube, Going Slow to Go Fast and Other Unexpected Turns in the World of Competitive Rubik's Cube Solving. The book is available through our friends at Amazon.com. As I mentioned, it's already a bestseller there, so you guys can get it in its many forms there. Of course, you can also go to your favorite bookstore. If they don't have it, they'd be more than happy to order it for you. And Ian, you are very active, like the rest of us, on social media, because you and I connected there. How can our audience stay connected with you as well?
So that's a great point to make. I'm active and always happy to interact with people on Facebook at Ian Scheffler Author, on Twitter, and on Instagram. Oh, and there's also my website, which is ianscheffler.com.
So make sure you all are definitely staying connected with Ian. Ian, again, I know this is a busy time for you, so thank you so much for the time, and looking forward to having you back again.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a real pleasure.
Well, good. I appreciate that. The pleasure is definitely ours as well. And we thank you, our audience, for tuning in to another great segment of Conversations Live. If you all came in late, you missed part of the conversation with Ian, don't worry. Thanks to our online friends, you all can catch the replay right after we go off the air. The link is already available through our social media sites. And I've already tagged Ian, actually, on Facebook and Twitter, so you guys can actually find him there as well. So go over to our page at facebook.com/CyrusWeb, or you can go to twitter.com/CyrusWeb. If you click on the link there, you can listen to the show completely for free and share it with your friends from there as well. Until next time, I'm your host, Cyrus Webb, saying as always, enjoy your day, enjoy your life, enjoy your world. Make sure you take out time to enjoy some good music as well as a great book. Thank you all for choosing Conversations Live today. You all make it a great one.